WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From the world of literary academia comes an insightful look at the culture of professional boxing. Carlo Rotella, an English professor at Boston College, has just written Cut Time and Education at the Fights. Rotella finds both savagery and art in the fight world, and he believes careful study of its craft and characters holds valuable lessons for life outside the ring. Rotella takes readers to a variety of scenes in boxing, an aging trainer telling stories in a gym, an over-the-hill puncher scrapping on a Saturday night in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and an intimate look at heavyweight legend Larry Holmes, who, Rotella writes, lands punches with the straight and true authority of a master carpenter driving nails. Carlo Rotella's writing has appeared in the Washington Post magazine, Harper's, and other publications. Let's start with a reading from the book.
In a club or at the garden, the pre-fight scene is always fundamentally the same. The ring girls, in bathing gear and high heels, have draped other people's jackets around their shoulders to keep warm. Guys in suit and tie from the state commission walk back and forth with great conviction, glad-handing and trying to look busy. The referee for the first bout bounces lightly on the ropes to test the tension, then straightens his bow tie. My favorite local referee is Eddie Fitzgerald, a smiling gentleman with flowing white hair who breaks fighters out of a clinch as if making room to step between them to order a highball. He taps them briskly on the shoulder as if to say, "Gentlemen, there's no need to fight." The promoter walks by, flush and tight, usually managing to make his priciest clothes look like a $40 rental. He stops to rub important people's necks and shoulders. He points across the room with a wink or a grin to those who don't merit a stop. He looks over the crowd filling up the hall, pressing in on ringside from all around. Cornermen and old fighters stand in clusters, talking about the time Bobby D got headbutted by that animal out of Scranton. Photographers check their equipment and load film, like infantry preparing to repel an assault. Print and online reporters hang around, gossiping. Some of the deadline writers have plugged in their laptops to begin laying down boilerplate.
Carlo Rotella, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
People think of boxing as Tyson and Ali and Evander Holyfield, but your book gives us a look at boxing in small places with small purses. You talk about going to Allentown, Pennsylvania, with your student who was training to be a fighter and watching a card of matches there, including a guy named Art Bayless, who, as you describe, as old in fighter years, taking on a fellow named Exum Spate. What was interesting about that bout to you and what you admired in Bayless?
Well, Art Bayless is better than what's called an opponent. That is, he's not expected to lose every fight, but was not a guy who would be challenging for any significant title or purse ever again in his life. He was a guy I'd seen train in the gym and a professional, but in no sense a celebrity. And that night, he was fighting Exum Spate, who was a professional opponent. That he was one step below Art Bayless. He was expected to lose, but to put up a good fight.
Now, when you say a professional opponent, you mean what?
I mean that a fighter who is brought in by a promoter, and the promoter can expect that guy will be in shape, will look like a fighter, will put up a good fight, and will probably lose to the hometown favorite. So an opponent in the sense that he will put up a plausible fight. What happened in this fight is that against the sort of implicit schedule of the promoter, Exum Spate cut Art Bayless very, very deeply next to his right eye. During the fight, early in the fight, and watching Bayless labor through this long, long fight with blood pouring down his face and figuring out a way to win the fight was one of those moments in which you say to yourself, there's some lesson inside of this, and I'm going to try and tease it out. And, I'm not a deadline writer. I let the fight gestate for months and sit around and try various versions of it and try to get at what it is that makes the fight interesting or makes the fight a lesson.
And what Art Bayless knew was, apart from just dogged persistence, footwork, defense, what?
Well, not only that, but he also knew that he was fighting a guy who would get tired, who would who had a moment early in the fight, and had actually, what happens sometimes to someone who's expected to lose when he does something very good early in the fight is he gets excited and burns up too much energy trying to win the fight, or burns up too much what you might think of as psychological energy. Worrying about the possibility of winning the fight or how deeply he's cut this guy. And he basically waited Exum Spade out is what he did. And the fact that as he was waiting him out, he was pouring blood sort of supercharges the moment. But it's really a lesson in some ways in patience.
You said that most fights are mismatches. Why is that? I mean, don't people enjoy even competition?
I think they do. I think that there's not that many people left who would recognize even competition in a boxing match. I think most fights that you see involve, especially at the lower level, involve a local fighter matched against an opponent who's brought in to lose the fight. I'm not saying the fight is fixed or it's faked. It's that that the difference in ability or in experience is enough that it's pretty certain what's going to happen. But to most of the people there, cheering, rooting for their guy, looking at their guy fighting somebody who's pretty much the same size and looks muscular and mean too, it looks like a fair fight.
And so the promoters do this. I mean, in effect, they've arranged a what's likely to be a show whose outcome is fairly predictable.
That's usually true. And in fact, in the book, one promoter says, you know, what you try to do usually is match a hometown guy with a good win. Now, there are moments, many moments at the fights, when two fighters do elicit one another's best work and something unexpected happens. It's just that those moments are rarer than one would think, and sometimes they're not as self-evident as one would think. There hasn't been a moment like that in a Mike Tyson fight in years, whether he was winning or losing. But people still expect somehow a Tyson fight to be a contest of equals, and he hasn't been in a contest of equals for years.
Fighters who are professional opponents, that is to say, guys who are used to being brought in and losing to a hometown favorite, why would you stay in a game like that?
Well, that's a fine question. Fighters will often talk about money, but if you do a simple calculation of the amount of suffering, pain, and training in relation to the amount of money they're making, that's obviously not a sufficient explanation for why they do what they do. And neither is, I think, seeking glory or seeking celebrity, even local celebrity. I think those two, in balance with an investment in craft, begin to explain it a little better. That is an investment in being good at this extremely difficult and esoteric and challenging thing.
But so someone who is a repeat loser, someone who is brought in to be an opponent to a hometown favorite, is somebody who gets some satisfaction out of training and knowing the craft, even if they lose most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget that person can beat the tar out of any athlete in any other in any sport, and anybody else on the street. Even the most abject professional loser is one of the best fighters in town compared to the general population. And what you find sometimes with professional opponents is they take a great pride in being able to have this life in which they travel around, get in fights, lose them, don't get hurt, and come home with a paycheck. And let's also not forget that before that fight, they stage the ring walk with the music playing and everyone cheering and the lights are on them. And it's a kind of a moment that most people never get to enjoy, and a professional opponent gets to enjoy or gets to experience every time he loses a fight. In some ways, it seems to me that it's worth losing the fight to them to have that moment.
You spent a lot of time with Larry Holmes because you taught college in Easton, where Larry Holmes is from and currently owns a gym. He's an amazing character. I mean, still boxed into his late 40s, even early 50s.
Yeah, and still active as we speak, and still trying to set up a fight with George Foreman, who is now talking about becoming active again at the age of 54.
Now, why does he keep training so hard and keep coming out of retirement? What's the lesson there?
I dedicate one chapter to trying to figure that out with him and try to give him a chance to speak his piece at length. He's one of the better talkers, to my mind, in the fight world. Says what's on his mind without running it past some sort of internal marketing department first. And in our conversations, he at first talks a lot about money, but then works his way towards other things, like the display of technique and craft. And below that, below even bringing honor to his family, below the fact that he grew up poor and really doesn't want to pass up a payday when he knows how to do this so well, way down there, I think, is also his place in history. He's aware that his peers are mostly dead, which is the all-time great heavyweight champions, and he's thinking about where he's going to fit on the list with Joe Louis and Muhammad Ali and Rocky Marciano.
And it's interesting that anybody can walk into his gym in Easton, where he is not particularly friendly, you say to people, but will occasionally bark out an admonition. Like what?
Usually a profane one, which I can't repeat on the radio, but usually to a fighter to stop messing around or doing something unnecessarily flashy and to concentrate on the task at hand, whatever it is.
Those comments that he makes in the gym are to guys off in a corner who he doesn't even know, but he is offended at their lack of discipline and devotion to the craft, right?
Or if they're doing something slightly wrong. And one of the stories I tell in the book is there was a girl, a 12-year-old girl, jumping rope in the gym, and she was doing it wrong. At least Holmes thought she was doing it wrong, and he goes over, he gets out of the ring, and he goes over, and he jumps rope for her to show her a better way to do it. And it's a moment that stays with me because here's this grandfather showing a little girl how to jump rope, and they're both there with their hands taped, trying to do this thing properly. And the fact that he even saw her, you know, with the eyes in the back of his head while he was busy doing something else is startling enough. But then that image of him saying, look, here's how you jump rope, has stuck with me.
Our guest is Carlo Rotella. He's the author of Cut Time, An Education at the Fights. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carlo Rotella, an English professor at Boston College. His new book is called Cut Time, An Education at the Fights. When we left off, we were talking about former heavyweight champion Larry Holmes. Rotella got to know Holmes at his gym in Easton, Pennsylvania. You've written about his confrontation with a curiosity, a fighter known as Butterbean. Tell us about that one.
Well, Holmes, as he approached 50 and then past 50, had the problem that he could still fight. But he couldn't find anybody worthwhile to fight because anybody who was a champion or a contender or even aspired to be a contender someday wouldn't go near him because they could only look bad. If they lose a fight to a 50-year-old man, then that's the end of a career. And he's still difficult to beat, and you're not going to look good doing it. So he couldn't get fights with people who would represent a good payday, and then the people who did want to fight him were not prominent enough to get a good TV contract. So he was stuck. And in that moment, Butterbean appeared. Now, Butterbean had come out of the tough man competitions. He was kind of a TV celebrity, but not a particularly good boxer. So,
well,
Butterbean
describe him. I mean, he was a huge.
Well, he's a very wide, short, shaven-headed guy. You know, he's less than 6 feet tall and has weighed 300 pounds for a fight. And the big thrill for people with Butterbean is that he's this big fat guy who apparently can't be hurt and. Has knocked out a series of patsies and opponents in four-round fights. And as he got a little older, Butterbean started to want legitimacy, and he was one of the very few professional fighters in the world who stood to gain credibility by fighting Holmes and could command a pretty good TV contract. So he finally got Holmes in the ring with him, and Holmes won every round and won an easy decision and walked home with most of $1 million, which is a kind of a not only a paycheck that Holmes is not going to pass up. Remember, this is a guy who grew up eating government cheese, but this is also it's also a chance to fight in a packed arena in front of thousands of cheering people and to show that he's a real boxer and has command of his craft in a way that, say, Butterbean, who's the bigger celebrity at this point, doesn't.
And Butterbean was a massive man with huge punching power, but against a guy who knew what he was doing, he was completely feckless.
And even the huge punching power is open to question. He's a big fella, and I guess if you stand right in front of him and let him wind up, he could knock out even a good boxer. But no self-respecting boxer is going to stand in front of him. I think he hit Holmes, you know, maybe twice flush in the whole fight. And Holmes was 52 at that point, right? And Butterbean's in his 30s. And it was just a case of, you know, when Holmes is 70. If he had a chance to fight somebody like Butterbean, the same thing would happen. I mean, there's a level of craft that's never going to go away. in a way that even punching power will go away eventually. But an ability to take care of yourself, block punches, handle spacing, leverage, I think that will never go away.
You describe a moment in watching Larry Holmes in his training gym in Easton where he's feeling some discomfort that might have been related to an ill-timed meal. Tell us that story.
This was a moment that happened fairly early on when I started hanging out there. Holmes was training. He was sparring in the ring, and he sort of came back to his corner rubbing his stomach, and he said something that I couldn't really hear to his trainer, and his trainer said, "Go ahead," and then stepped away very briskly. And then Holmes, to say it as plainly as possible, stuck his hand down his throat and made himself throw up over and over and over until his stomach was empty. He had eaten lunch a little late, and it was a little too close to sparring time, and his stomach was bothering him. And it was one of those moments where, one, you realize that you've entered a world in which a different set of rules applies. And it was also a funny sort of a ringside moment because there were some other people hanging around there, and we all looked at each other like smiling and grinning as if we were all very pleased that he was doing this because it's the right tool for the right job. You know, this is what you do if you've eaten too late. You stick your hand down your throat. And it was this, on the one hand, a kind of a repellent moment, but the more I thought about it, is a moment that actually helped pull me into thinking about what is it that makes fight people tick? What is it that makes fight people want to continue doing what they do?
After he fills the bucket with vomit, he washes his mouth up, and it's back to business in the ring.
Yeah, and the other element of that moment that interested me was that everybody in the gym, that is, stopped what they were doing and watched him do this. And when he was done and said, "Okay, I'm getting back to work," everybody went back to work with double the diligence they had before, as if he had shamed them or demonstrated to them, "Remember, this is, we're doing this with our bodies so that we can do this difficult thing." And everybody sort of rushes back to work with redoubled energy, and he goes back to training. And it's one of those moments when everything in the gym stops and then starts again. And in that stop and then in that start again, something has just been revealed to you about how the fight world works.
Carlo Rotella, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Carlo Rotella is author of Cut Time, An Education at the Fights.